You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Tim.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
You know, that's exactly the word I was going to use. That's just a weird coincidence. I was going to say great. So that makes two of us. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You are Timothy B. Lee, proprietor of the highly successful newsletter Understanding AI, also host of the recently revived podcast AI Summer. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation because, for one thing, a lot has been happening in AI. And for another thing,
always.
But I see this gets at the other thing that I'm excited about this conversation is that there's a little bit of an intellectual tension between us on this subject. Let me lay it out, and I'll give you a chance to correct me if I've mischaracterized your position. But all along with AI, there have been, you know, to oversimplify, two camps. On the one hand, people say it's going to be hugely, unprecedentedly transformative. Brace for impact. Some of these people think it's going to be great, some not so great, whatever, but dramatic. I fall in that camp. In fact, I have a book coming out next month called The God Test, and the subtitle kind of underscores my position. It is artificial intelligence and our coming cosmic reckoning. I do think this will be the most dramatically transformative technology in the history of our species, to put it mildly. Now, on the other side of the debate, kind of, there have been, well, a variety of people. There have been people saying, oh, this is all marketing hype. Pay no attention. That isn't you, Tim. And in any event, I think that's a dwindling number of people. Then there have been people more like you, who said, yes, it's going to be very important, but let's be careful not to overstate things on, you know, the job displacement front, the chances for AI takeover, and rogue AIs, and various things. And that's been kind of your position. In fact, you have said we should think of AI as a, quote, normal technology, and I'll give you a chance to say what you mean about that. Now, in the last, I don't know, 4 to 6 weeks, there's a kind of a new context for this whole discussion has arrived with this much heralded model from Anthropic called Mythos, which has reportedly unprecedented skill in terms of finding and even exploiting software vulnerabilities. And, you know, this has been taken so seriously, I would say, that it's actually changed the policy debate. I mean, I'm glad to hear that we are now more than before discussing about the possibility of, you know, government regulation, maybe even somebody within the Trump administration use the FDA as a kind of metaphorical comparison. In other words, maybe the government should evaluate these products before they're released. And also in the international context, this is what I find most gratifying. Is with, you know, with the China summit coming up, more people starting to talk about the need to coordinate policy with other countries, especially China. In any event, you have been on the not so fast front. That's often your view on regulation, I'd say. And tell me if I've got that wrong too. But anyway, with that, having set the stage with that, I think we'll use this Mythos moment as an opportunity to have a version of a larger conversation about, you know, how big this thing is going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the things that's hard about talking about this is, like, there's a wide range of possible, like, bigness, how big something can be. And, you know, I started an AI newsletter, like, right about it full time. So clearly, I think it's important. I think people should pay attention to it. I think most people should be paying more attention to it than they are. But there's a question of, like, how big is big. So my view is, if you look back at the last 200 years, you had breakthroughs like the steam engine, like the internal combustion engine, like electricity, like semiconductors and the internet. I view AI as similar in magnitude. And, you know, those first five I mentioned are probably five of the most important inventions in human history. Like the last 200 years in some sense has been profoundly abnormal. If you told somebody in 1500 or 1000 that you know, the last 200 years were going to happen, they would have been very surprised. But I think in that context, given that we all grew up, you know, at the tail end of that sequence of inventions, I think AI is, I think of it as kind of in the same line. It's a very important technology, a technology that will allow humanity to continue the extraordinary 2% annual growth that we've had over our lifetimes and for the century or two before that. But I don't see, there are people who see it as dramatically more important than those kind of technologies. And it's, I'm not convinced that that's the case.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just set the stage with Mythos, because there are a couple of things about it. There are the hacking capabilities, and then there are the evaluations of, I guess, the kind of larger capabilities of the model by this group called METER. That's the acronym, M-E-T-R.
Yep.
Something evaluation and threat research, I think, are the last.
Model evaluation, yep.
Yeah. And their work has gotten a lot of attention. Yeah. Because what they started doing, it's a very interesting methodology, a couple of years ago, is looking at models that came out at various points in time, the frontier model at any given time, the strongest model at any given time, and seeing what kinds of tasks it could do and how long that took, and comparing it with how long it took a person to do. So the metric is kind of human hours or seconds required to do a given task. The tasks were largely encoding, not exclusively, but that's obviously in a way particularly relevant and particularly easy to measure, I guess. I could go on about the methodology, and I'm sure controversies about it. But the basic idea, the basic finding was: look, the human labor time of the strongest model at any given time has a doubling time. Originally, it was 7 months. It was so. In other words, today, a model can do with, say, 80% success rate what it would take a human 15 seconds to do. In 7 months, it'll be able to do 30 seconds. Now, as you know, Tim, any doubling time thing, you know, a fixed interval of time that doubles every time, that's exponential. So if you chart it out, the curve is going to get steeper and steeper and approach vertical. But then they found that not only was the doubling time of fixed interval, it was of shrinking interval. And then the latest, when they do this with Mythos, it suggests, like, once again, you know, if you look at the straight line that you get if your y-axis is logarithmic, you know, it's above that. So in other words, the curve is getting... Seems to be, and this is true with the last couple of models, I think, according to their methodology, the curve seems to be getting steeper, even faster than a fixed doubling time would suggest. And that keeps being the case. I don't know what they're saying the average doubling time is now. So anyway, and this, of course, speaks to this issue of ultimately what's called recursive self-improvement, where I guess the AIs are just reaching in and improving themselves. But the run-up to that, obviously, is an accelerating effect that's largely due to the fact that advances in AI coding accelerate the pace of AI advance, and hence the advances in AI coding, positive feedback loop. I would say we're seeing some signs of that. So anyway, I would say those are the two things about Mythos. First of all, what most of you probably heard about: dramatic increase, apparently, in hacking skill, and what are the implications of that? How worried should we be? And then there's the broader context of just rate of acceleration. Now, I don't know what you'd say about those things.
So I would say two things about the METER results. First of all, it is very important work. METER is a great organization, and I think it's a clever way of measuring, because the thing that's really valuable about it is previously people tended to have benchmarks with tasks of the similar difficulty, and so you'd have when you first introduced a benchmark, maybe no model could solve it, And then you reach the point where the models can solve most of the problems, and you go very quickly from like, you know, 5 or 10% solution to like 95%, and then it's not useful anymore. And that made it harder to measure over longer time periods, like how much better is today's models than a model a year or 2 or 3 years ago. And so the metered folks have this interesting metric of task length, how long of a task can measured in human minutes or hours or seconds can a model do. And the way they do it is they try to bracket it. So they have some, the hope is you have some tasks that are too hard for the models at any given point and some that are not hard enough. And by kind of finding where that middle point is, you can say, okay, this model is easier than these tasks, but harder than that task, and that corresponds to this many minutes or hours of human work. What's happened recently is that it's really hard to have long tasks. It's hard to actually find a task that's a 10 or 20 or 30 hour human task. And it's even harder to, you got to hire a person. They actually tried to hire people to do it so you can get the, so you can have an accurate assessment. You don't just eyeball, you say, we actually hired a person to do this task and it was 30 hours. Now, if you think about trying to extend that into 50, 100 hours, if you try to find a competent programmer and said, here's this fake 100-hour task that we're going to do just for modeling purposes, you know, programmers have day jobs and you have to pay them a lot of money and et cetera. And so the problem that Meter has is that they've reached the upper limits of their jobs. I think the most difficult jobs they have are like 30-hour tasks. And they're getting to the point where the models can accomplish some of those tasks. And then statistically, the way this model behaves is when you get to that upper bound, the error bar gets really huge. So I forget the exact number, but their estimate for Claude Opus 4.6 was between like 5 and like 60 hours or something. And so clearly there's been a lot of progress, but I think we can't say very much about, I mean, we know Methods seems to be better than previous models, but I think that doubling time statistic becomes less and less meaningful because they haven't done the work of like finding the 100 or 1,000 hour task that you would need to continue to do this in a rigorous way. So that's one thing. The other thing though is I think the nature of tasks change as you get to longer time horizons. So if you think about I as a journalist, if you give me an hour task, it might be, write this short piece or edit this article, right? And those are things where you can give a clear, here's the input, here's the output. Right. We have a clear like definition, right? If you think about something I do over a week, it's like do a podcast with Bob. It's like talk to three other sources. It's write 11 other documents. It's go to lunch with somebody. They tend to be much more open-ended and they tend to interact with the real world. Like you're not just, you don't have clearly defined inputs. A lot of it's like, who are we going to talk to? They're interactive. And so I think part of what's happening is as we get to these longer time horizons, they become less and less representative of what humans do over long time horizons. And so I think, and I actually think this is closely connected to the way these models are trained. There's a technique called reinforcement learning, where you give the model a task, you say, did it complete it correctly? Mm-hmm. If you did, you reinforce the aspects of the model that caused that success. If you don't, you change the weights to get a different result. That has worked very well. And so for these tasks that are self-contained, easily defined, easy to measure the outcome, they really are getting better and better at those. And that is significant. That's great. But humans also do many things that don't have that characteristic.
Right.
They're open-ended, that involve interacting with the real world.
Can I just interject what this points to about kind of the stakes of the conversation, which is that you're right, like, you know, it gets harder and harder as you expand the time horizon to come up with a task that you can study in a laboratory. It also gets kind of, in a certain sense, from the human point of view, scarier and scarier because you're moving up like the org chart chain, right? Uh-huh. Like if you ask like what's like your goal for a month, well, it might be to increase your traffic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, well, that's a very sophisticated, you know, strategic challenge, very, very, you know, complicated strategic challenge. And you keep going up the time horizon chart and you're just moving up the org chart. And the question becomes, what jobs are left that these things can't do? And that, you know, now these are big questions. So you're right that on the one hand, we're reaching kind of the limit of the methodologically pliable stuff within this one realm of evaluation, but that itself signals something a little frightening, right?
And, yeah, absolutely.
And I would say people are just anecdotally reporting that they're moving up the chain. I mean, I haven't used OpenClaw myself. I haven't, to much to my shame, even used Claude Code. I plan to. I keep saying this is the weekend I'll have the time. But you've seen the reports. I mean, people are saying, oh, my God, you know, this is like I'm running an organization of 20 people, except they're all agents. And so I'm wondering what your reaction, partly to the anecdotal stuff, is. And also, are you yourself surprised? Would you have predicted this a year ago, 2 years ago, where we are with the, not just the coding ability per se, but the autonomously agentic use of the coding ability? In other words, you know, you give the thing a complicated goal. You say, look, I want an app that does this and this and this, and you start the conversation that way. And you unleash it, apparently, when, you know, it's still a pretty complicated thing for the thing to figure out, and yeah. It does a good job.
So I would say, I think I would have said, I hope I would have said a couple of years ago that I had a pretty wide error bar for what, you know, how quickly things would advance. And I would say this is a little bit above what would have been my like median forecast. So definitely like progress has been substantial. I think the anecdotes go both ways. So there definitely are people who are using Claude Code or OpenClaw heavily and are getting impressive results from it. Certainly the programming profession is changing dramatically. But I also think you see quite a lot of what was called technical debt, where if you vibe code something, it works pretty well on first blush, and they're like, oh, this has bugs, or oh, this doesn't actually solve this other thing, or it becomes much more annoying to fix bugs as they come up. Actually, the traditional software I use has these features that I wasn't like thinking of when I vibe coded this, but actually it's like, you know, there's some value to the traditional approach. And I think you see the same thing with OpenClaw. People will automate a bunch of things, and then after a while they're like, oh, I'm not actually using it as much as I thought, because, you know, it turns out there are things it can't do. So I think there's a lot of that kind of two steps forward, one step back kind of thing, where there's excitement once we have a new capability, and then there is kind of growing realization that actually this has some downsides or some limitations that weren't obvious. Because the way these things are trained, they're trained to like mimic human abilities. So on first blush, they seem very human. And it takes a while to figure out what are the more kind of more subtle things that humans can do that we haven't captured. And so that's how I see it. I think that in retrospect, we're going to see this as an era where there was rapid progress, but also a lot of problems were created. And like I have friends who are in the IT business, and they're constantly having their CEO or people in sales or something are like, oh, I vibe coded this. Can we like add it to our corporate network? And they're like, and they are foreseeing that, oh, this is going to open up security vulnerabilities, or this is going to be a problem we have to deal with once they get tired of it. I see pluses and minuses to it.
Yeah, and let me be clear on kind of my own position. I'm agnostic about a lot of things. I don't know how high up the org chart this will go, or whether it'll go all the way. I mean, but I'm convinced, or whether there's going to be, you know, widespread job displacement, and in 2 years there's going to be a bunch of people who don't have work. I don't know. What I feel confident of is that there's going to be tremendous turbulence in this realm and in a lot of realms. So, you know, it may be that the people whose skills become obsolete, which I think is going to happen on a pretty large scale, maybe that they can find new things to do. And I want you to get into the argument of this guy who I think just got a job at Google, an economist type job.
Yeah,
who's
Emas.
On your podcast. Yeah. What's his name?
Alex Emas.
Yeah. So that's on your podcast, AI Summer. And I want to get into that argument eventually today with you, or that discussion. But I don't really know what's going to happen. What I feel confident of is that a lot of people are going to have to find new jobs. They may or may not succeed, but yeah. If they want jobs, they're going to have to find new ones. And even if they do, that's just turbulent. It's just socially turbulent. And I think there are a lot of fronts along which that is true. You know, parents are going to be going, oh, my God, how do I adapt as a parent? And that takes time. Educators are going to be doing that. There's going to be new kinds of criminal threats, new kinds of international criminal threats, geopolitically destabilizing effects. I just think it's going to be an earthquake, and we're starting to feel the tremors, and I could get into what I think we need to do. But I just wanted to be clear on that. And I'm curious what you'd say about that. Just level of impact, leaving aside the scenarios that I know you're skeptical of, like full-on AI takeover, massive enduring joblessness, and so on.
No, I agree with that. I just think like the 20th century was a very turbulent century. The 19th century was a very turbulent century. Like I think the 21st century and then the next couple decades are going to be similar. It's going to be, there are many, many previous events that had big social and political impacts.
Actually, just to be clear, then we don't agree because I think it's going to be more turbulent, but go ahead.
But like, I don't know, the 20th century was very turbulent. You had two world wars. You had a lot of traditional jobs that became much less, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs. So, I mean, I guess I'm not sure how to quantify, like how, you know, I don't know if you have like a metric in mind or like a reason for why it's going to be much more turbulent. But the world looked radically different in the year 2000 than it did in 1900.
Yeah, although, I mean, it was turbulent. But the question of how much of that turbulence was technologically driven is another question. And arguably, one of the biggest technological developments was kind of stabilizing, which was nuclear weapons. That may be the reason we didn't have a war among great powers, because they had nuclear weapons and they realized war was a massively lose-lose game now. But in any event, what I just mean is, you know, how short is the period of time during which dramatic transformation happens? And look, I will admit that in principle, adaptation, you know, that happens faster too. When dislocation happens faster, you're also in a technological environment where in principle the social adaptation can happen faster. It's just that traditionally there has been lag between those two things. I would say social media is an example. I would say there's a reason John Haidt's book has been on the bestseller list, The Anxious Generation, for a couple of years, because parents are still freaking out about social media. And
think that's a good analogy. I mean, you know, the iPhone was invented in 2007, and by 15 years later, like, teens' lives have been totally transformed. I think we'll probably see a similar thing with chatbots. And I think certain professions will see a similar 10 to 20 year time period where you know, certain creative professionals will see dramatic transformation. I guess whether that's a big effect or a small effect is kind of how you want to label it. But that's the kind of time frame. Like, I don't think 2030 is going to look dramatically different than 2026, but I think 2040 probably will for a number of professions and a number of aspects of our lives in a similar way to teens' lives with regard to social media.
Yeah. So you want to drill down a little more on one of these? Maybe we should.
Let's talk about mythos. I think that's an interesting example. And I think you were mentioning earlier this idea of a normal technology, which is a coinage from a couple of computer scientists at Princeton. So it's their view, not mine, but I think it's basically correct. And one of the things they've written a lot about that I've been thinking about a lot is the like offense-defense balance. And so I think the view that mythos is going to be radically transformative, I think in some sense assumes that it's going to advantage attackers. So this idea that mythos has the ability to find new exploits in software. And so certainly if you just handed Mythos access to Mixos to the world's, you know, terrorists and foreign governments and so forth, it would be somewhat destabilizing. But the thing I think has been interesting is the way Anthropic has rolled it out. They've provided it to a select list of companies that run the most important infrastructure in the world's operating systems, world browsers, the world's major, you know, banks, things like that. And the hope is that that's going to give them enough of a head start that they'll be able to fix most of the bugs that exist that this model is able to detect. And then the longer term thing, I think I'm very optimistic about this because on some level, there's a finite number of bugs in any piece of software. And if you lower the cost of discovering the bugs, the defenders, the people that own a particular website, get the chance to audit it for vulnerabilities before the attackers do. And the hope is just the whole internet's going to be a lot more secure because you'll check for vulnerabilities before you release it, and by the time you release it, it'll be they'll just have many fewer vulnerabilities than they did in the past. And so that seems like a stabilizing force more than a destabilizing force with regard to cybersecurity.
Yeah, I've heard conflicting arguments on whether it inherently favors defense or offense or neither, and I'm not fit to judge. What I would say is it's literally disturbing in the sense that it It disturbs pre-existing balances of power in a very sudden way. I mean, let's just look at us in China, you know? Yeah. Like if we suddenly knew China had this, we'd be freaking out. I don't know what they're doing. And of course, it's unlike Americans to say, hey, I wonder how they're reacting to this. Americans, you know, that would, a question like that rarely enters American foreign policy discourse. But we'd be freaking out, right? I mean, we freak out at much smaller stuff than that in China. And that's just kind of, and sometimes when people freak out and worry about a threat from their biggest, most potent rival, they do rash things, right? And, you know, there was this, well, I'll leave it there for now, but, you know, you can, one thing I'll say is that it makes it, you know, I've said before that the American chip restrictions, like, I'm even technically agnostic about those. It's not like I'm against them. I just wish the discussion of them were more richly informed by thinking about all the implications, including the fact that obviously if China starts feeling that we're the ones getting the benefits from those the chips coming out of the factories in Taiwan, and they're not, and of course our chip restrictions have exactly that effect, then however likely they were, however tempting it was to invade Taiwan, it's more tempting now, okay? You can't really argue against that by some measure at least, it changes their cost-benefit calculation. I just wish people would, like, talk about that kind of stuff, and they very rarely do. And this is just another good example of that. If you're China, and you're like, shit, they can suddenly, wait a second, they can suddenly find bugs throughout our infrastructure. Maybe they can take down our power grid, whatever. We need to start thinking about crippling their future advance in AI, okay? I'd love it if I had heard anyone say what I just said, but I haven't. And that's why I'm just saying, like, look, I don't know exactly what's going to happen with AI, but it's going to be dramatic, and we need to be talking about it in a way I don't think we're yet talking about it.
Yeah, I agree with most of that. I'm not a huge fan of the export controls, and I definitely think people should, in national security context and other contexts, should be talking about it more than they are. So, I think we're on the same page there.
Yeah. Now, do you think? What about the, do you think its capabilities have been overstated? The one issue is, like, how does it compare to OpenAI's latest model? I'm still confused about that. I mean, one kind of comeback from skeptics to Mythos was, well, you know what? If you look at a lot of other models, including some that existed before that, they actually do, there are certain tests that they do pretty well on. I mean, they've been getting better and better. This isn't as dramatic a leap as you think. And this new OpenAI model that I guess kind of came out a little after, I mean, I don't know whether, I still don't know, is the latest 5.5 or whatever it is that SPUD or what? But they say, isn't that, I mean, I don't know how this cuts, which way this cuts, but isn't that the equivalent of Mythos? Then, you know, this guy, Zvi Moshewitz, whom, you know, I'm sure, AI kind of analyst, said, no, actually, Mythos has, it was something like, it's, yes, in a certain sense, raw skills are comparable, raw hacking skills, but it has more autonomy. That was my takeaway from his analysis to the extent that I could even grasp it. But anyway, what is your, is Mythos itself being overstated and just in terms of what an advance it is?
I mean, people have said a wide range of things. So certainly there are people who portrayed it as this is a model that can, like, hack into any computer system. And I think that's overstating things. And I think it's true that, like, there's been a pretty steady progression. I don't necessarily think that Mythos is, like, a huge leap, a much larger leap than the leap from, you know, Opus 4 to Opus 4.5 or whatever example you want to pick. It's the next step in the progression. But the progression has been pretty fast. I mean, you know, Anthropic has been putting out new models every couple months. And so if you compare it to, like, a year ago, it's a big leap, whether, you know, however you want to kind of measure the last jump. It also seems like Anthropic does have a lead over, like, I think, again, we don't know for sure since they haven't, like, made it available widely, but it does seem like Mythos is probably a little more sophisticated at this kind of thing than OpenAI 5.5. I mean, certainly OpenAI seems to feel that way because they chose to release it to the public and Anthropic didn't. So, like, I think the skeptical people, there are some people who say this is, like, all hype or that, and they pointed out that a lot of these vulnerabilities, actually, if you show it to previous models, that the previous models can also find that. And I think that's a little bit still, because it's a little bit like, who was I seeing? I was seeing somebody who was comparing it to Where's Waldo. Like, if you show somebody a Where's Waldo page and you, like, circle Waldo before you hand it to them, obviously they're going to find it quickly. The test that people did is they said, okay, we're going to take one of the bugs that Mythos found, and then we're going to prompt another model and say, look at this specific part of the code and look for a bug. And obviously, if you point to a specific part of the code, that increases the chance that it'll find it. What's impressive about Mythos is just give it the whole system with very little hints, and they're able to find it spontaneously. So, but ultimately, I don't think it matters that much. I don't think that the question really is, like, is Mythos a huge leap versus previous models? It's like, what's the progression? And very clearly, is Mythos is the most sophisticated model that's existed, and its predecessor was a little more sophisticated than one before that. And if you go back 2 or 3 years, it's a night and day. And so I think it's just very clear this is going to be significant. But it is still, it's not like infinitely sophisticated. Like, there is still room for improvement. And there's still room, I think, to use this for defensive purposes. And hopefully the long run equilibrium will be a good one where defenders have an advantage over attackers.
Yeah. And then what about the policy implications? I mean, those two issues, kind of national and international. At the national level, you know, the Trump administration, as I said, is suddenly kind of making noises. I mean, they walked this back a little after blowback from part of their base, but making noises about an FDA-like thing. Kevin Hazlitt, who I think is he's chief of the Council of Economic Advisors, or is he something else now? Anyway, Trump guy used the FDA analogy, said, you know, maybe we should take a look at these products and kind of the government should take a look and clear them before these new models are released. That was the basic idea, which is kind of funny because Trump came into office saying that the Biden administration's regulations were crippling the AI industry, and he killed all of them. And they weren't even that strong, as I understand it. All they said is if a model is beyond a certain point of power, then the labs had to provide the government certain information about it or do certain. I don't think it explicitly said we then have the power to deny it a license. So anyway, what Trump is talking about is at least what some in the administration are talking about and maybe walking back even as we speak is something at least as strong, I think, as the Biden administration supposedly crippling regulations. And, you know, among the people who think even the FDA thing would be going too far or even any FDA-esque like thing are David Sacks, who I think is still, I heard something about him stepping away from his role or something, but I don't know. Is he's still AI czar?
Last I heard, I'm not.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah. Sure. So on his podcast, he said, so an FDAI is a solution to a problem that didn't exist. It's a classic, never let a crisis go to waste, power grab. The cyber threat is real, but the only solution is for American companies to use AI capabilities for cyber defense. The U.S. has a multi-$100 billion cybersecurity industry whose job is to prevent breaches. They should be deputized to help drive this effort. I think he has in mind companies like CrowdStrike, you know, security experts like, yes, they should be given access soon. I don't know if he means the government should do the deputizing. I think the idea is, look, Anthropic handled this responsibility. You can trust companies. Well, what's your take on this?
I'm not sold that we need a licensing regime. It seems like it's still a bad idea. I do think that, and mostly because I think the companies are doing a pretty good job on this. I mean, the scariest thing for me, or potentially scariest, is biological weapons. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's some question about could somebody use an AI model to help give them instructions on how to create some kind of biological, you know, synthesize a new virus or something like that. And I think all the labs are concerned about this and are doing a significant amount of work to prevent it. And as long as that's true, I'm not sure that like a licensing regime would help. I think the people who really want a license regime are worried about AI takeovers and, you know, autonomous agents like trying to take over the world. And I just don't think we have good measures for that. I don't think that's likely to happen, but I don't know how you would test for that. What I will say, the policies I wish people would do is just investing more in infrastructure. The U.S. has an organization called AC, the AI Safety Institute, that's part of NIST, that I would say is underfunded. And it would just be a great idea to increase its budget, have them hire some more experts to be, you know, you don't need to, you can, the government can do testing without having a formal licensing regime, can provide technical support, can provide advice to administration officials and people in Congress. Like, the U.S. government needs more of this infrastructure. And I would say if you're concerned about these safety issues, the first step is to make sure the government has the capacity to do these evaluations in a rigorous way. And then 6 months or a year from now, if it seems like things are getting more dire, at that point, you're in a position to maybe put in place more regulations. But jumping straight to regulations before the government has the capacity to like do testing in a meaningful way seems kind of putting the cart before the horse.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I'd say about the regulation issue is that it points to a broader, very challenging thing about AI, which is, on the one hand, I think there often is a theoretical case for regulation. I mean, I personally think I too worry about the bioweapons thing, but I also think bioweapons are almost a metaphor for some threats AI poses in other realms. And actually, if you imagine an AI hacking machine that goes rogue and, you know, hops from whatever, computer to computer, data center to data center, satellite from satellite, I don't know how exactly it worked, but, you know, amasses power as it goes, stealing compute, learning more. Like, that's like a bioweapon in that it doesn't respect national borders. So your national policy alone cannot make you secure. Let's assume for the time being that the lab, the coronavirus emerged from a lab in China, whether it did or not, it obviously could have. No amount of national policy could have made Americans secure from that. And I think there are a lot of downsides of AI, as well as many, many upsides there are. But there are a lot of downsides that I think have that property of not respecting borders. And for that reason, I think bioweapons are, in addition to being an actual AI threat, a good metaphor for other AI threats. But the larger tension I think this points to is between, on the one hand, the theoretical argument for regulation that I've just laid out, and I've also just suggested national regulation is not alone. You're going to need international regulation. But on the other hand, the danger, I would say the unique danger or distinctive danger this technology poses if the control of it is centralized, right? Like, this is, you know, it seems to have a persuasive power. It seems like you could unleash it in social media and say, go convince a bunch of people that Trump is a great guy. And maybe now the bots would be easy to spot. It's not clear that's always going to be the case. Or go convince them that Elon is a great guy. And actually, that may have happened. But either way, a concentration of power is really distinctively concerning. On the other hand, whenever there's regulation, which there's a theoretical need for, there's some centralization of power. That's kind of, I mean, well, there typically is. It's a hard thing to get around. To me, this is one of the huge challenges. That's one reason I'm kind of agnostic about a lot of things, like how we handle this. But I do think we should recognize that full speed ahead is not necessarily the best thing because there are so many things we need to think through. And this is one of the biggest, most generic of them, the trade-off posed by centralization of power. It has very important things that can be accomplished, and it has terrifying things that could result.
Yeah, I mean, if there was a lever you could push that to make AI progress 10 or 20% slower, I might push the lever.
I've got some ideas, but go ahead. But they always get shouted down because then China will beat us. If we put a tax on data centers, China would beat us, and so on.
Yeah, I have not read your book yet, so I do not don't have any comments on that. But I mostly agree with what you said there.
Okay. So I want to, I mean, we're at the point of the conversation where move into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. There's a link in the show notes. You can go to nonzero.org and become one. You just look for this post, which will be there on the homepage, this conversation. That'll lead you to where you need to go. And Tim, you've been kind enough to stick around for overtime. But first, I want to give you a chance to say anything else you want to say about this. Now, in overtime, I want to get at this, the employment issue that we alluded to, and various other issues, including some recent industry things, some of them having to do with the concentration of power. Suddenly, Elon, I mean, all of these companies have a growing number of interconnections. There's a very small number of very rich guys and very powerful companies that are basically in bed with the government, and not necessarily in a bad way, but in the sense of financial, some degree of financial dependence on it. And maybe we'll get into that. But anyway, among the recent industry news is now suddenly Elon is a hyperscaler. He's providing compute to Anthropic, which we had thought of as one of his rivals. Google's invested in Anthropic. Amazon is. There's all of these, interdependencies. So I want to talk about recent industry developments. Maybe we'll have time to get into the highly entertaining trial involving Sam Altman and Elon Musk. But before we do, before we bring down the paywall, Tim, what else do you want to say about this? And also maybe about stuff you've got going on in your newsletter, Understanding AI, or podcast, AI Summer.
I mean, people should subscribe to my newsletter and my podcast. We're working a lot on some stuff about robots in the next couple months. My colleague Kai Williams just did a trip to China, and we're going to have some pieces about the state of robot technology and what's going on in the U.S. versus China, et cetera. So I don't have anything to say about that yet, but if people are interested in that, definitely that.
But that reminds me, I want to get a self-driving car update from you in overtime as well, because you write about that a lot and you know a lot about it. And I hear conflicting things about whether Tesla is or is not poised to pose a very serious threat to Waymo.
All right, let's do it.
What's that?
Let's do overtime.
Okay. So again, check out Tim's stuff. And if you feel like pre-ordering my book, The God Test, I suppose I wouldn't work hard to dissuade you. In any event, thanks everybody who's followed us this far. And now we're heading into overtime.